Right? The title of tonight's class is I Don't Care What You Think. I Know I'm Right.
Okay. I like that. That's a good title. End of the year class.
Yep. I don't care what you think. I know I'm right.
Are you?
Am I? Yeah. Are
you? Talking about grandchildren, Monroe has an announcement.
Oh, let's hear it, Monroe. Go.
My son's
putting
engaged.
Him on the spot.
Oh, my God. Congratulations. Also
he went to Chicago and got engaged, and my granddaughter's walking, so...
She took her first steps today.
Oh my gosh, mazel tov.
That's beautiful.
Well, she's walking all over me.
That's what happens, right, with the grandfathers.
I hear that. All right. Hey, Marcia, nice to see you.
Hi, nice to see you guys.
All right. So tonight, from the Parsha this week, we have to look at a certain passage or two, a certain verse or two, that I think if we understand it correctly, it gives us an opportunity to take a step back and look at a concept. This is not just specific for this parsha, for this portion. It really, I think, is a very powerful lesson in human relationships. So let's do the following. This week's parsha is known as Vayechi. It is the last of the portions in the book of Bereshit, in the book of Genesis, which is still difficult for me to comprehend. I know that I follow along week by week, but to think that we're already moving into book number two with the Exodus and the whole story and that, like, I feel like I'm just getting to know the patriarchs and matriarchs still, but it moves very quickly. But this is the last parsha. Like I said, it's known as Vayechi, and it's the story of where now that Jacob, let me start back, Joseph, just refreshing our memories. Joseph has revealed himself to his brothers, shell shock, fine, convinces the father, Jacob, to come down with his entire family to settle in a suburb called Goshen, right? That's where they're going to set up shop. Our parsha begins with, after they had been there for a while, Jacob is now reaching the end of his life. And he calls together all of his children, and he gives each one of them a blessing, each one that is a blessing that is specific and unique to the character of each one of his children. Similarly, actually prior to that, is where he calls in Joseph to bring his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. We've heard of them. And it's the famous blessing that many of us give our children on Friday night. This comes from this week's Torah portion. We say that this, to the men, to the boys, we say, Yisimcha Elokim ki Ephraim v'Menasheh, may God make you like Ephraim and Menasheh. And to the ladies, we wish them to be like the matriarch, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. That comes from this week's Torah portion. Okay, switching of his hands. Jacob switches his hands to put his right hand on the younger son, Ephraim, even though Menasheh was the older. You're all shaking your head. You know exactly what I'm talking about. Perfect. I'm not focusing at all on that. That was just to whet your appetite. The end of the parsha is really what I want to focus in tonight. Jacob actually passes away. Now, he makes Joseph promise. Joseph being second in command of all of Egypt, he has the authority to fulfill this wish. Jacob makes Joseph swear that after he passes away, he's not going to bury him in Egypt. He has to be taken out of Egypt and brought all the way back to Canaan, to the cave of Machpelah. Remember that cave? The cave in which the patriarchs and matriarchs are buried. Yes, Jacob makes Joseph swear that he will do that. And sure enough, towards the end of the parsha, the last chapter of the portion of the whole book, really, tells us that after Jacob passes away, Joseph seeks permission from Pharaoh to do it. Pharaoh gives him the permission, go up, bury your father as he had made you swear. So fine, they all go up. There's a whole entourage, really a huge procession following the coffin of Jacob. And they bury him in the cave of Machpelah. Here's where it gets a little cool. The Torah says the following. His sons did for him exactly as he had instructed him. His sons carried him to the land of Canaan, and they buried him in the cave of Machpelah field, the field that Abraham had bought as a burial estate from Ephron the Hittite, facing Mamre. Joseph, listen to the words carefully. If you have a Chumash, it's chapter 50, verse 14, if you're following along. I feel like we're at a ball game, you know? If you want to score this, make sure you're on the right inning, okay? 50:14 is where we're at. It says, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father, after he buried his father. It's a very funny expression. The simple understanding, before we delve into it, is that after Jacob is buried, they all headed back down to Egypt. Everybody. The very next verse, Joseph's brothers perceived that their father was dead, and they said, quote, perhaps Joseph will nurse hatred against us, and then he will surely repay us all the evil that we did him. So they instructed that Joseph be told, your father gave orders before his death, saying, thus shall you say to Joseph, oh, please kindly forgive the spiteful deed of your brothers and thus and their sin, for they have done you evil. So now please forgive. And they ask forgiveness. Notice the juxtaposition. Notice the two verses next to each other. Jacob is buried. Joseph and everybody heads back down to Egypt. And that's when it occurs to them, hey, Jacob has passed away. Now Joseph now's his opportunity to take revenge against us for all the harm that we caused him all those years ago. Hate to break it to you folks. Jacob passed away he passed away from the time he passed away till they buried him is a couple of weeks, months almost. Because they mourned for him for 30 days before the procession even started. So why is it after he's buried, doesn't say that's when they got it. It's after they are on their way back. They perceived, Arlene, there's that word. They perceived something more. Something was strange. And now the light bulb went off in their head and they start getting nervous. Uh-oh, Joseph is going to take revenge. Why? Why now all of a sudden? What triggered all of this? So I want to share with you a fascinating midrash, fascinating insight that we're told. If you listen to the verse carefully, you'll notice something strange. And I think this is what's bothering our sages, that they investigated and saw something different. If you were writing the sentence that Joseph and everybody, his brothers and all of those that of the entourage went down to Egypt, I think you would have phrased it a little differently. I'll read the verse again so you have it clear. The verse reads, again, it's verse 14. Joseph returned to Egypt, parentheses if you want, he and his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father, end parenthesis, after he buried his father. If you wanted to write the sentence that everybody returned, how would you have phrased it? Would you have done it differently? Or you're okay with this? Nothing strikes you about it.
I would have put Joseph and his brothers buried his father and went back down to Egypt. It wouldn't be Joseph went back down and, by the way, everybody else did.
Right. Very good, Ellie. Is that what you're going to say, Robin?
No, I was going to say they said buried twice. Bury the father, and then they buried the father. Like, they said it twice.
Well, so, it says after he buried. That's true. After he, right. But it's phrased almost as if it's separate. Joseph returned to Egypt. What do you mean Joseph returned to Egypt? Joseph, his brothers, and all the entourage returned to Egypt after burying their father. That's how I would have phrased it. It almost breaks it up as if to imply the way Joseph went down is not how the brothers and everybody else went down. They almost went separately, which is exactly what the Midrash tells us. Listen to this Midrash. The Midrash asks, what did the brothers see now that made them fearful of Joseph? Says the Midrash, upon their return from Canaan, after burying their father Jacob, Joseph left the group to visit the pit into which years ago he had been thrown by his brothers. Oh, Joseph, you'll forgive the pun, but Joseph made a detour and made a pit stop. He made a pit stop. He went. Now, mind you, where the cave of Machpelah is not exactly next door to where the pit was, but he figured he hasn't been back to Canaan for so long. He doesn't even know if he's ever going to get the chance again. He made a decision that he was going to go to the pit, and then on the way back, he would stop there and go back. Let's not theorize why yet. But note that this is what the sages see in the verse that screams and says, something must have happened, that Joseph went, he returned to Egypt. Oh, and everyone else also went down after burying their father. They went separately. The question that the Midrash then goes on to address is, why? But before we get there, let me ask you, put yourself in the place, in the position of all the brothers. You're one of the other brothers. And you know, after burying dad, we're all going to head back down to Egypt. That was the deal. That's how Pharaoh gave him permission. And Joseph takes a detour. And he's going to the pit. Tell me, what's running through your mind right now? You're one of the brothers.
Push him in again? No.
He's not, they're not there.
I know.
What's running through you? Tell me, human nature here.
Yeah, they're worried that now Joseph is going to remember all of these things, and with his father not there, he's going to be angry at what they did, except for Joseph knows why all of this happened, so it doesn't make sense that he would really be angry.
Well, let me ask you, from the brother's perspective, why is he going to the pit? What's running through their head? Why would he possibly be going back to the pit?
To remember what took place.
Yeah, to basically psych himself up for now taking revenge. I mean, isn't that how you would have understood it had you seen it yourself?
Yeah.
That would have been the first thing that came to my mind. Why are you going to the pit? Bingo. Oh, that's why the very next verse says they were afraid that Joseph was going to take revenge, and therefore they came to him and says, well, dad told us to ask forgiveness and yada, yada, yada. You understand the connection now. What does the fact that Joseph returning to Egypt have to do with them asking forgiveness because they're afraid he's going to take revenge? Because that's what's running through their head after seeing him go to the pit.
That means that they never really grasped the whole fact of that for Joseph, that these were not dreams, that these were messages from God, and that him forgiving them was also part of that. So they never internalized that part.
I don't know about the internalizing, but I think whether they understood the prophecy or not, they were quaking in their boots, because if this really is the fulfillment of those dreams, we're in deep you-know-what.
Because they didn't have their father there to protect them anymore.
Yeah, not even protect, but even Joseph wouldn't have the chutzpah to go ahead and exact revenge against his brothers while his father's still alive. That would be so painful for a father to see. So now that he's gone, you see, before I saw this midrash, I just thought a simple understanding. Dad's not here anymore. Okay, this is what Joseph must be, you know, now's his opportunity. But what I think our sages are teaching us is looking to analyze the text a little bit more and say, but what triggered it? Wasn't just Joseph, now that dad's gone, he's going to take revenge. Something triggered it. And he went back to the pit. the question that we now have to ask ourselves is, why did Joseph go back to the pit? Because his response when the brothers come to ask forgiveness, what do you think he says? What would you expect him to say?
I've already forgiven you.
Along those lines, it's even more than that. Listen to what his response is. Joseph said to them, "Fear not, for am I instead of God? Although you intended me harm, God intended it for good, in order to accomplish, as is clear as this day, that a vast people be kept alive. You have nothing to fear from me, brothers. God had a master plan. Your role in this just triggered, but the end result is that I got put into a position of authority to save our entire people. I have no anger. I'm not harboring any anger."
But he had told them that once before.
Well, so then why, Sharon, did he go to the pit?
Maybe he went to reinforce his mission. And it says that, you know, Joseph returned to Egypt, and then later the other ones did. Maybe it means when Joseph returned to Egypt, he returned as who he was supposed to be. He was second in command. And the others just returned as, you know, they were there. They were his brothers, but he came back as the viceroy. And maybe he took that side trip to remind him he's the viceroy, but he has a bigger mission. And by seeing the pit, maybe that helped him.
Beautiful. to ground him as to where he came, his roots, where he came from.
And one more piece.
And what he was supposed to do.
Go ahead, Robin.
He on a mission from God.
Oh.
I was gonna say God told him to do that because then the brothers would ask for forgiveness, and then that's what he was looking for. God.
There's a fascinating law that's codified in the Code of Jewish Law, that if there's a miracle, an absolute crazy miracle that happens to a person, I don't know, you know, you hear these crazy stories of God forbid, a car goes off, you know, through the guardrail and halfway down, and somehow miraculously you can save the kid who's, you know, 30 feet away. I don't know, crazy stories. The law is that when you return to that site, you have to make a bracha. You make a special blessing thanking God for that miracle. Listen to this medrash. It's the second half of what I quoted earlier. Joseph's intentions were sincere, says the midrash. He wished to fulfill the obligation of reciting a blessing upon the place where a miracle occurred to him personally. The brothers, however, misunderstood. To them, Joseph was reminding himself of what his brothers had done to him at that site. Now, with their father deceased, Joseph would no doubt repay his brothers for their actions. Says the Midrash, Joseph had 100% good intention here. He wanted to go back to the site and say, wow, not only did I get a miracle performed for me that I survived this, but I now have the luxury of the full picture of history of how it all played out exactly as God wanted it to be. For me to be in a position to say, can you imagine how fortunate we would be if we had the luxury to look back and say, wow, that's what this must all be about. That's what Joseph wants to do. But the brothers misunderstood. You're with me on all this?
Mm-hmm.
Here comes the hard question, ladies and gentlemen. Did Joseph do anything wrong?
Say it again.
Did Joseph do anything wrong in this scenario? Alan, you're extremely quiet.
Rabbi, I think that he went to the pit with the guys following him, and he said, yep, it's big enough for all you guys. Don't mess up.
Problem I have
you
with
think
it.
Egypt is tough. Take a look at this.
Exactly.
The problem I have with it is, while he meant good, because he didn't explain what he was doing, because what really twists me is is verses 16 and 17, where the brothers decide that they have to pretend that they have had a message from Jacob to give to Joseph saying, please forgive them right. and everything. And that's just making something up. That's making, in some ways, it's making it worse.
It's funny you say that. One of the options for tonight was to explain that sentence as to when it says, well, your dad commanded. There's nowhere explicitly in the Torah that he actually commanded that. However, many of the commentaries point out from another action that Jacob himself did that would have been the life lesson that they learned it from. But I chose not to talk about it, so we won't. But listen to this. Go ahead, Robin.
I was going to say, was there something that we had talked about before, and I don't remember in what context, that you're supposed to not make other people feel bad? In a sense, you're supposed to not, you're supposed to be like, you know, not that he intentionally did it, but it's supposed to be something where you're not supposed to.
But let me ask you, if I know I'm doing the right thing, do I have to worry what you think and perceive of it?
Right,
I know what I'm doing is right. This right. is the question of the night, folks. If I know what yeah. I'm doing is right, am right. I obligated to worry about what you might strangely think is and misunderstand? Is that my problem?
I thought that was something we learned, yeah, before, that you're supposed to worry about that reaction that the other person has.
Yeah, but I think
I'm doing the right thing.
I think Joseph just needed that time to himself to gather his thoughts, to do the bracha, and that, I mean, yeah, you can look at it that he didn't tell his brothers what he was doing. It caused his brothers worry and to make up the thing about Jacob. But, you know, I mean, how often have many of us just said or, you know, just needed that.
That's fine.
Time to yourself.
But is it my response? I know what I'm doing. Did Joseph, let's get facts clear here, folks. In truth, did Joseph do anything wrong by going to the pit? The answer is unequivocally no.
No.
Nothing. No. He didn't violate anything, didn't transgress anything. He knew what he was doing was right. His intentions were 100% sincere.
But he didn't take his brothers
misunderstood and misinterpreted the whole thing. That's his problem?
No.
It sure seems like it. It seems like from this midrash that they are taking
feelings into consideration.
What?
He didn't take their feelings into consideration.
Why do I have to care what you misunderstand? It's one thing that if I do something that's questionable or something that might be harmful for someone else, yes, then I have an obligation to take your feelings into consideration. But I'm doing something that I know is right. God agrees with me it's right. It is the right thing. Because you're fakrumped in the head and you came up with some crazy, wacky idea, that's my fault?
Maybe he didn't think about it. Maybe he didn't think what his brothers were thinking at the time.
Why should he have to? It's not
their own guilty consciences.
Thank you, Marshall. Yes. It's their guilty conscience. What does it got to do with Joseph's fault?
It's not.
You're going to agree with me. One second, Robin. If you're going to agree with me, Sharon, then you have to explain. The whole point that the Midrash is making is that while it was sincere and Joseph's intentions were right, he is being held accountable. That the brothers had to now feel that way and come and ask forgiveness. That is the Midrash is holding Joseph responsible.
But it wasn't until after the fact. Why?
I don't understand why.
He didn't think about it at the time. He had a plan. He stayed to that plan, and it was afterwards that all this other stuff came up.
Okay.
And then he made it accountable. I'm sorry for upsetting you not telling him. But it's not his responsibility.
But that's my point, Sharon. The Midrash is making it clear. It is his responsibility. What the Midrash is trying to convey to us. The reason why the brothers had to come beg forgiveness and grovel is because Joseph left that door open incorrectly. He should have told them. My question, which I'm going to answer, if you give me a chance, is to why why it is his responsibility, even though, as Marcia correctly pointed out, he did nothing wrong. It was their guilty conscience. Nevertheless, the point the Medrash is making, which we're going to have to explain, is the life lesson. It is your responsibility. Even though they came up with it on their own, they misunderstood. Their guilty conscience got them all famished in the head. You still have to worry about it. That's correct.
But didn't Joseph already forgive them? That's the part, yes, I'm grappling with.
He didn't. The words, "I forgive you," I don't believe were stated. I believe that what Joseph did was try to alleviate their fear by saying, hey, God had a big plan here. But the conversation of forgive or not forgive,
I mentioned in the previous.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in the previous parasha.
Okay.
Let me develop this a little more. And then if you want to jump through the video screen and come strangle my neck, go right ahead. But give me a chance to explain. Let's jump to another story. It's a little bit later on in the Torah. The Jews are getting ready to finally cross over the Jordan and to enter into the land of Israel. Okay. Prior to that, Moses lays out, although he's not going to go in, he lays out what the expectations are. Is that all the nation, all the tribes are going to go in, conquer, divide up the land, and everything's going to be great. All of a sudden, in the back of the room, two guys raise their hand. Moses?
I don't think so.
You don't think that's how it happened?
No. I mean, that's the space. We like it here.
Yeah. They raise their hand like, you know, this side of the Jordan, it's kind of nice. We got lots of cattle, lots of sheep, got lots of grazing land. What do you think? We'd like to stay. What sayeth you? Well, Moses' response is as follows. If you do this, before that, that's the second answer. He says to them, absolutely not. You may not choose to stay here. Why? Because it's going to create a fear in the rest of the tribes. They're not going to know that you're doing it for the right reason of you have cattle and you want grazing land. It's going to be a demoralizing effect on the rest of the troops. Oh, they don't want to go. Do they know? Do they have intel that we weren't told about? I didn't get that memo. How come they're at, whoa, why are they not going in? So Moses says, no dice. Fine. Here's his response. Moses said to them, if you do this thing, if you arm yourselves before God for the battle, and every armed man among you shall cross the Jordan before God until he drives out his enemies before him, and the land shall be conquered before God, and then you shall return. Sounds like a good plan, right? Listen to Moses' words carefully. His next words are, then you shall be vindicated from God and from Israel, and this land shall be a heritage for you before God. You will be vindicated in the eyes of, who would you expect that to read? Who do they have to get vindication in whose eyes? God. That's the only one that really matters. Do the right thing. But that's not what he says. He says, if you do it this way, not only will you be doing the right thing, you'll be enforcing this idea and not harming in the eyes of everybody else. You're doing the right thing. You have every right to stay here. But if you come across first and you help fight, then not only will it be good in the eyes of God, then everybody else in the nation will understand it as well, and you'll be vindicated in their eyes as well. Why is that so important? Because that is the rule. You must consider the ramifications of what someone else might think. And I'm going to go even further. Even if you're 100% right, and their thinking is wrong, yeah, you should still do the best that you can to alleviate that misunderstanding. That's on you. Now, I know the next question. Michelle, you don't even have to say it. I got it. The question you're going to ask me is, Rabbi, Didn't you tell us, or I'm sure Rabbi Cosman told me this, that isn't it a person's obligation to always judge their fellow favorably? Isn't there that obligation on the other person when they see me do something, they should give me the benefit of the doubt? Wasn't that your question? Come on, come on.
That wasn't my question, but that is true. But that I don't see why that's not wrong. I don't see why that's a problem.
It's not.
Because right. I don't see it as a problem.
It's right. People, unfortunately, they just gloss over it. They are not mutually exclusive. In fact, they're complementary.
Yeah, Lou.
That's the beauty of it. Exactly. The beauty of this concept is that you have it coming from both sides, looking out for the betterment of the other one. That's exactly how it should be. Let me explain, because I have some blank looks over there. My obligation, if I'm doing an action, even if I know it's right, I still have an obligation, which we see from the story of Joseph, and we see from the story of Moses talking to those two tribes. It's my obligation to clear up any possible misunderstanding of my actions. Even if my actions are good, 100%, I still have the onus of responsibility to try to the best of my ability to make it clear. In the case of Joseph, he could have simply said to them, I'm going separate. I'm going to the pit. Why? Because I want to thank God for I see the whole pit. And he could have simply explained it. The fact that he didn't, that's on him. However, the flip side is the brothers are guilty of not judging and giving him the benefit of the doubt. They should have looked at it and also said, well, what could he possibly be going to the pit for? They immediately jumped to the negative conclusion. Oh, must be, he's going to psych himself for revenge. When in fact, there was another option, the real option, and that they could have given him the benefit of the doubt that he was going to thank God, that he was going to see this bigger picture. Each one of them could have seen and taken into consideration the other one. And that is, my friends, a powerful lesson in all human relationships. This is what you should not say. I don't care what you think. I know I'm right. That is not correct. From a Torah perspective, even if you're 100% correct and the person who sees it is totally blowing it out of proportion, way off base, still on you to anticipate to the best that you can all of people's crazy strategies and thoughts and schemes. Yeah, that's right. It's on you to do that. Yeah, Sharon.
It just sounds like with everything you do, you have to constantly be explaining yourself, whatever you're doing.
I wouldn't say it that way. I would say with everything you do, you should take into consideration what could it be perceived as. Doesn't mean I have to explain myself, but I would think twice, oh, maybe I shouldn't do this now. Let me do it a little bit later so that somebody might see me. I'll give you many examples in a minute, right? But it's a matter of training your brain to think, what might someone misunderstand? I'm not saying I'm doing something wrong. It goes without saying that if you are doing something wrong, think three times. But even if you're not doing something wrong, you still have to train your brain. What might somebody think? As crazy as it may be, what might they do? And what can I do to prevent that? That's the process you have to think. Yes, Raman.
So it's really about perception, like we were talking about with Ian. It's all about the perception that you have to perceive that other people may have another thought.
Yeah, yeah. The great master, he's known as the Chassam Sofer. His last name was Sofer, and he was genius. He once said that when he read this verse about you shall be vindicated from God and from before Israel, he wasn't worried about the vindicating before God. He was more worried about the vindicating before the other people, because people got some strange thoughts. That's what he said. People think crazy things. Yeah, that's what it takes. Let me give you a few examples, okay? Where this really plays itself out. I once had the opportunity when I was living in Ohio. The Federation there had put together, was wanting to put together what they called board excellence training. They wanted all, they had many organizations and many, synagogues and other schools. Anyone that got money from the Jewish Federation, you know, they wanted to train board members to be good, solid board members of Jewish institutions, which meant they were teaching great, they wanted to put together a curriculum that would focus on board training and have the Judaic piece, because obviously it's a Jewish organization. So I was asked to write the curriculum and teach the Judaic piece of it. Made sense. I wasn't happy doing the other part, so they gave me the Jewish piece. You know, play a rabbi on TV long enough, you can fool anybody. So one section was on fiscal and fiduciary responsibility. What a board member has to know, taking care of institutions' money, their own relationship to it, and how they deal with it. So for example, we broke it down into three parts. One was called duty of care, that you have to treat others' money as if it's your own. You can't just be glib about spending someone else's money. Every money, every dollar that comes into an institution, take it seriously. Don't waste. You have to have that level of care. That was one section. Then there was something called duty of loyalty, which meant that you had to be honest and have the level of integrity to that organization's mission, what it was all about. If your mission was to provide food for the homeless, then buying, new Chromebooks and new laptops for the whole office and all of their first cousins, well, that's not duty of loyalty. That's not in the mission of this, you know, the statement of what the organization is all about. It certainly included not taking bribes, whether they be actual or even, this is our line, perceived. Allow me to explain. How far a person has to go to avoid even the perception of financial mismanagement. I'll give you an example. The Talmud says, and it's quoted again in the Code of Jewish Law, collectors of charity are not permitted to separate from one another. You must have two collectors working. Why? Because if one guy gets it, who knows? Maybe he's side pocketing a few extra dollars. Gets worse. If a charity collector found coins in the marketplace, he is not allowed to put them into his pocket. Why? Because imagine you only caught the second half of the scene. Everybody knows he's the charity collector. He's holding money and he doesn't put it in the big bag of charity. He pulls out his wallet and puts it right in his wallet. Now, technically, let's be honest. Whose money does that belong to? Him. He found it out in the public area. He's entitled to keep it. Nope. Perception. Somebody might see the charity collector putting money in his own wallet. But wait, gets worse. If a charity collector was owed money by someone and the debtor repaid him in the marketplace, he's not allowed to put them in his pocket. Same idea. He's owed the money. And the guy is finally paying him back. And he says, sorry, I can't take it. I'm on the job. Come to my house later or I'll come to yours. I cannot take money while everybody's looking or perceiving I'm the charity guy and I put it in my own pocket. Wait, it gets worse. Charity funds should not be counted two coins at a time. Come on, we've all done that. You got all them, the coins spread out and you put two fingers and you go 10 nickels, 10, 20, 30, 40, right? We don't do 5, 10, 15, 20. Who's got time for that? No, you're not allowed to do that. Why? Because counting charity money, if you're off by a nickel, that's on you. That's what it means to have the level of responsibility But look how far we go that it not be perceived. Oh, you ate? You want more? I'll give you more. All the Jews donate money for the building of the tabernacle, the Mishkan. Okay? You have the people who are in charge, Bezalel and Eliyav, they're the architects. They're overseeing the whole project. Yet the Torah begins at the end of the book of Shemot. It says that Moses gave an accounting, a reckoning of all that was donated. Okay, I want to be the heretic tonight. I don't get to do that too often. Okay, if Moses was the treasurer of your organization, Moses, right? And he tells you that he kept good records. And here's what we have to build the tabernacle. We got this amount of gold and this amount of... I want to know which one of you is going to have the chutzpah to ask him to show you the books. Who's gonna question him? I dare you. Yet the Torah tells us that Moses didn't wait to be asked. He forwarded the accounting and the reckoning of every piece of gold, every piece of silver. Didn't matter. Why? Because of this idea. If you're in charge of something, if you're perceived as made, can you imagine what would people say? Let's say you were the treasurer. I don't want to pick on anyone in particular. We'll talk about some other dude, some other organization. Nobody we know. I'm not going down that road. Nobody we know. He's the treasurer of organization. Okay? And amazing. He does a great job. And he's a treasurer. He's got a decent job. He does this as a volunteer. Makes a decent living. Okay. And he's the treasurer for this organization. And within 2 years, magically, he's a millionaire. How'd that happen? How did that? Now, let's come on. We got to give people the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he took a little bit of money. He invested it. Maybe, you know, he didn't know at the time, but last February, he bought stock in masks and aprons and, you know, and he made a boatload of money. But what are people going to think? Even if you want to tell me he didn't take the money that he wasn't supposed to, but maybe he borrowed it to make the investment. He doesn't have that cash on hand, right? We know that guy. Yeah. People talk. People come up with mushagas. They come up with crazy things. Yeah. That's why the law is what it is. The one who's appointed to take funds out from the community chest is not allowed to even enter the room if he's wearing a garment that has pockets or even a hem. Even a hemmed garment. Why? Because what can you put in the hem? One coin. You say, come on, Rabbi, you're getting a little kooky here. No, we're not, because people think crazy thoughts. This guy couldn't hold down a job for more than 10 months at a time, and now he's a millionaire 2 years after being the treasurer of this organization? Sure. It could be legit, but that's how people think. He's not allowed to enter that area where the money is kept with a hollow belt. Or with sandals or shoes, or he can't go in with anything you can hide a coin in. Why? Lest he become poor. People are going to say, he must have misappropriated. God got him for that one. Or lest he become rich and people are going to say, he must have used the money from the treasury. You can't win. That's why I recommend nobody go into anything with Jewish communal life. Right, Marcia? It just ain't worth it. It's not. You can never win. Never. I'm kidding, right? But that's how far you go with this. Why? Because our perspective cannot simply be, I'm telling the truth. I know what I'm doing is right. That's not enough. It's not enough. You do have to take into consideration the perception. Even Moses. Yeah. What are people might say? That you have to keep into consideration. It's not enough to say, I don't care what you think. I know I'm right. You darn well have to care what someone thinks, even if they're crazy. That's on us. But like I said before, on the flip side, we also have the obligation to look at everybody else and give them the benefit of the doubt. So hopefully between the two pieces, you get to a nice balance of where everybody's looking at the better side, right? It's especially true for leaders, especially true for anybody in a position of authority. Keep this thought in mind. It's not my way or the highway, even if it's right. Perception is a large part of it. Questions? Nah, really? Come on. You know you want to argue with me. Come on. You're still not comfortable with it. Come on.
I still think the brothers were right in following him to the pit and he sizing up the pit to the man. That was the message.
I guarantee you the second book of the Torah would have been very different.
Yes. Well, he didn't have to. He just looked at them and said, yep, it's big enough. And then yeah, that was
that's it.
It.
He didn't have to say that. He just have to look.
Exactly.
It's a very important idea, folks. It really is. It really is a wonderful lesson for all of our relationships. It really is. All right.
Yeah, I was thinking about, you know, when you're texting or you're doing communications on the computer or something like that, when you don't see the person and you don't hear the tone, it's difficult to really know what the intention is of some communications. And if you're not careful, you have to be very careful because somebody can perceive it in the wrong way.
Very true.
And that's why I hate doing that kind of communication. I'd much prefer face-to-face because you get so many more cues and absolutely clues.
Absolutely. That's a great point. There are many situations like that.
Michelle, on that, I always text in capital letters. I did. Because it was
not supposed to.
I know. It was easier for me to see. And I text my daughter and she goes, Mom, why are you always yelling at me? And I was like, what do you mean? She goes, when you type in capital letters, you're showing that you're yelling. Yeah. And it's like, I'm showing that I can see it.
Yeah.
It is.
See, your kids are not being perceptive that really, you know, we're not on the same level, many of us, as our children are with the technology.
Exactly.
I don't think that's a perception. I think that's a reality.
a quick question. Is there any other like prime example in the Torah of this?
What I gave you was not enough. in the Torah.
No, I mean, you gave us, you know, the Joseph and about, you know, the tabernacle. I'm just wondering if there's anything else.
I mean, I gave you the story that Moses with the two tribes who want to stay over on the other side of the Jordan. That's three. I mean, I can give you other, you know, scenarios that are not in the Torah itself, but where is it? I have it written here somewhere. Here it is. You know, one of the offerings that were brought in the tabernacle and in the temple was something called ketoret. Incense. They used to bring various spices and they would burn it. So there was one family in particular that were experts in arranging the spices so that when it burned, the smoke went straight up like a column. I don't know about you, but I've tried my hand not that often, but enough times with campfires, whatever it is, and you light it and the smoke goes like this. Whoosh. And instead of it going nice and up and it blows everywhere and everybody's coughing. Right. So imagine they did. So this family, they were known as the house of Avtinus, the Avtinus family. They were famous in the time of the Mishnah. They knew how to do this. It was recorded, not in the time of the Mishnah. They were recorded in the Mishnah. They had a rule in their family. They didn't want to share the rule. They didn't want to share their special secret, how they knew, but they had a rule in their family. The Mishnah reads as follows. Regarding the father, never did a bride go out of their house perfumed. They never let any of their daughters or daughters-in-law wear fragrant spices? Perfume. Why? Oh, where'd you get it? Oh, little leftovers that morning. You took a little bit. You know, come on. It's just a paper clip. No, they wouldn't let it go out. And when they would marry a woman from another place, they would stipulate with her from the outset that she could not perfume herself. She had to agree marrying into this family. Cannot wear cologne, cannot wear perfume. Why? So that people should not say they are perfuming themselves from the production of the incense. You like this, Robin? Listen to this. The end of that phrase in the Talmud says, they did this to fulfill what is stated. You shall be vindicated in the eyes of God and of Israel. It quotes the verse we were just talking about. That's what it means to live with that perception at all times. Yeah. Were they the only family that had that crazy rule? Yep. But what family doesn't have a crazy rule? That was theirs. Yeah. So that people shouldn't have the perception that they must have borrowed an incense or two from that morning. Yeah. That's what it means. You have to go that far. All right. Any other questions?
Yeah, Rabbi, that question that I emailed to you. Were
yeah,
you
I didn't do. I'm in the middle of. I don't have a great answer yet. I'm still researching.
Okay, that's fine.
I hope I'll get back to it at some point. I was hoping I have more time today to look further into it, but I didn't.
Okay.
But I have it on. I have it on a sticky, which means it at some point it's going to have to get cleared off. So I got to deal with it. Okay. All right, everybody. Have a wonderful night. A wonderful Shabbat. If I don't speak
have
to you
a happy
beforehand.
New Year.
Thank
happy
you.
New Year, everybody.
That have was, a happy New Year, everybody.
That's 4 months ago. Come on.
Plus, what's for everybody next year?
Yep.
That's so 4 months ago.
Okay.
Get over it, people. All right. All right. Have a great
Thank year. You.